to so generously for almost 60 years. You are the reason why we continue to do what we have been doing so long. A unique perspective within the arts, as well as music, as well as current events, public affairs, politics, and everything else in between. It's you, the reason why we could call this listener-sponsored media, and we thank you in advance for that. For those who are interested in becoming a financial supporter to this radio station, you can always go to give to WBAI.org online. Give to, the number two, give to WBAI.org online. Or you can text to donate, texting WBAI on your smartphone to the number 41444. You'll receive a link. The link becomes a page, and the page will ask you how much you want to donate to this radio station. You could donate as little as $5, and every donation is tax deductible, and we thank you in advance for that. It is now 1 minute past 5 p.m. Stay tuned for Advocating for Justice with Arthur Schwartz coming up.
We live in a political world, love don't have any place. We live in times where men commit crimes, and crime don't have a face. We live in a political world, icicles hanging down, wedding bells ringing, angels singing, clouds cover up the ground. We live in a political world, wisdom is thrown into jail. It rots in a cell, the sky that is hell, leaving no one to pick up the trail.
Good afternoon. This is Arthur Schwartz. The show is Advocating for Justice. We're on WBAI FM 99.5 and WBAI.org. I'm going to start with a just picking up on where Reggie left off, asking my listeners to pledge to, if you're listening online, to go hit that donate button. If you haven't, get a pen, write down 516-620-3602, or you can simply type into your computer, give to the number 2, WBAI.org, to help keep shows like this on the air. So while we wait for our, and we're going to wait a minute for our first guests, it is a crazy world that we live in, and it's been interesting. I think I made a point maybe a year ago, whoever thought that one would be on the side of a James Comey or a Robert Mueller, who were Republican, you know, G-men, who generally in the history of people who are progressive would not have been our friends. And there is an interesting question, and I don't usually talk about national politics on this show, but there are people who are saying it was spying. They were spying on people. The FBI does spy on people, even if they get subpoenas issued by a court. They spy on people, and that's a real thing. And the Sunday New York Times had a whole big focus of the New York Times this week was about the Sunday Times was about the degree to which your phone, your iPhone or your Android phone, tracks every movement that you make and knows where you are. And I was actually, for those of you who don't know, I'm a lawyer. I was representing someone this morning who was under investigation for something at his job. He worked for the city. And the investigators, who were just from the New York City Department of Investigations, they had his credit card. They had every charge on his credit card going back 5 years. They had a record of where he had traveled out of the country. They had his phone records, his cell phone records, his home phone records. They had his pay records. He hadn't the slightest idea. They had his bank account records. And they began asking him questions, some of which he didn't even remember. So it's a very scary society, and the spying that does go on, you know, is something that even though we may root for the FBI to spy on Trump, it's very dangerous stuff that's going on, and it's something that hopefully will get addressed in the post-Trump era. It has to be addressed. There's just too much that too many people know about our lives that we're not entitled to any privacy anymore. Anyway, I believe we have our first guests here. Our guests are Marianne Miller, who is one of the people who founded the Stop Cromin Coalition, and she did that on Bastille Day in 2007. And by the way, the Notre Dame apparently is about to totally crumble in a fire, which is a very sad thing. And Cynthia Chafee, who is also a member of the Stop Cromin Coalition. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So for those of you who don't, those of you who don't know, I said in my posting for this show that Cromin is New York's most notorious landlord. And these folks, we came in touch with each other most recently around his purchase of a building that contains the famous White Horse Tavern, a watering hole that goes back, I don't know, over 100 years in the West Village. Can you just tell us, your group is called the Stop Cromin Coalition. Is it part of a larger, you know, tenant protection organization?
Well, it is the Protection Tenant Association, and other groups have formed, and we do meet with other groups. But Cynthia heard me years ago. I had a show on WBAI called the Tuesday Arts Magazine, and I was doing the Artist as Activist, the series, and invited the people who were being displaced at 47 East 3rd Street, the Ecomonicus, where he took the whole building. And Cynthia listened in, and she called me that night. We met, and the Stop Cromin Coalition began.
So who is Steve Cromin? Who is he?
You want to take that, Cynthia?
Well, I think he's the most notorious landlord in New York City, in the history of New York City. Cromin's been involved in real estate following in his family's footsteps. He began buying buildings at 24 years old, and he's now 53 years old, and he owns almost close to 200 buildings. This is including with the six buildings down on Hudson Street. He wrote the book on landlord harassment. I think he's been like the poster boy for predatory landlords in New York. You know, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Steve Cromin said he couldn't be stopped. Well, yeah. We stopped him.
Yeah.
And he went to jail. He was sentenced to a year at Rikers. He never made it to Rikers. Spent 8 months at the Tombs. And from what he hear, he ran his business, 9100 Realty, from his cell.
Cell phone.
Yes, giving, as we said, new meaning to cell phone. So,
I like that.
I would like to also get back on the original forming of the Stop Cromin Coalition, because when Cromin took buildings over, people started, having tenant organizations forming in their buildings and, you know, meeting in people's living rooms. We met in our living room for years. And we expanded to even the tenants that were being did early on up from 72nd Street. And as the group got larger, you know, I met with Marianne. We both, you know, that day on Bastille Day, we formed the Stop Karma Coalition. But now it's morphed. It's morphed. It's so large. He's bought so many buildings, and he continues to buy so many buildings, that there's different areas of the city. We have a Stop Karma Coalition Health Kitchen branch. We got a Harlem branch. There's a large group in Murray Hill and the original Lower East Side. So no matter where he goes, no matter what buildings he buys, he terrorizes the tenants. I mean, they have been so tormented over the years. And there's not been a landlord who's done anything near to what Carmen has done.
Well, what are the kind of things that he did to people?
Or continues
to do to people?
Well, you know, he buys a building and he starts harassing the tenants with the court. He drags them to court, making them prove they're tenants. He wears them down financially and emotionally because he and his lawyers drag out the cases for years. Multiple adjournments that are so unfair. The court never even looks at the merits of a case. There's been so many frivolous cases that had absolutely no base for like saying that people owed money and they didn't owe money. But this has to stop. This is one of the next projects we have to make sure that they stop using the courts as an instrument of harassment.
So I want to ask you, he was indicted about 2 years ago by then Attorney General Eric Schneiderman for for fraud, which had to do with inflating his net worth, something I think Trump has actually been accused of. And he cut a deal where he got a year sentence, and he agreed to set up an $8 million restitution fund for some of his tenants. If he owns 200 buildings, that doesn't get anybody very much money. And he finished his sentence last June 1st. He wound up serving 8 months. He spent the whole time at the Manhattan Detention Center, which is just north of 100 Center Street, the criminal court building.
The Tombs, yeah.
Well, the Tombs is the part that's under the ground, but they actually built this structure above the ground. I'm sure he didn't spend a lot of time below the ground. And apparently, this is what the AG's office said. 100 of his residential properties will be run by an independent management entity for 5 years, plus an additional 7 years of independent monitorship to oversee compliance with the terms of a consent decree. The article I'm reading here quotes Cynthia saying, "This man served less time in jail for defrauding the banks of $45 million than a man stealing a tie from Macy's." But is his property actually being run by someone else, or is he basically back to running it himself?
Well, 110 of his buildings were taken away, and they are with a management company. And he can go to his places that he owns, but he cannot have any interaction with the tenants.
In those 110 buildings?
In 110.
And what about, but he has 200, you said?
Yes, 9,300 is functioning, running the rest of his the Croman Empire.
Yep. And I think they were the ones that were newly purchased that are not. I think the ones who he owned for a long period of time were under that number, being managed by New York City management.
Now, one of my criticisms, it's fun to pile onto Eric Schneiderman now that he's gone, but one of my criticisms is that a lot of times he settled matters for a tenth of a loaf, right? He would get an employer for discriminating against employees and get 200 people, $2 million, which only wound up being, you know, $5,000 a person or something like that. And so here, why did they only take 110 of his buildings when he settled to 2 years ago and he had 200? Was that ever explained?
Those were the ones that were involved in the lawsuits and the harassment cases. That's what the number, that's what then Eric Schneiderman, that was the buildings he went after. Maybe that was the buildings that he had committed the mortgage fraud. he would state that he had no rent-regulated apartments in the building, much similar to what the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, he did the same thing. And then they get higher mortgages if you have no rent-regulated apartments. So could be those buildings that were involved. And he had this high-priced lawyer, Benjamin Brofman.
So in this coalition, let me just first say we're on Advocating for Justice on WBAI 99.5 FM, and we're talking with members of the Stop Croman Coalition, Marianne Miller and Cynthia Chafee, Croman being one of New York's most notorious landlords. So has he continued to harass people in the other 100 buildings or so that he owns?
Well, recently he's been harassing people in all the buildings. He's been reported to have been knocking at tenants' doors in Harlem. You know, he's lurking around his buildings throughout the city. He's allowed to do it, but I don't think he's allowed to interact with people. But he has. He's questioned tenants what their names were. So we don't know what the Attorney General's office is going to do, you know, with this. But it's almost like he's defiant. He's thumbing his nose up at the law.
So what does the Stop Croman Coalition do, besides around the White Horse, which I'm going to get to in a minute?
We document what he's doing. We inform people of their rights. Mm-hmm. And we want to send him back to jail.
Have you had communications with the new Attorney General, Letitia James?
No, we plan on meeting with her soon.
Yes.
All right. What is the story with the White Horse? What's going on with the White Horse?
We believe
First, tell my listeners who don't know what the White Horse is what it is.
It's a old 1880. It was opened on Hudson Street at 11th mm-hmm. Street for the longshoremen along the piers. And it's been iconic, well-established tavern, and it's probably its most famous patron was Dylan Thomas, who wrote, "Do not go gentle into that good night, but rage, rage against the dying light."
Yes.
But others, Norman Mailer had a writer's salon, Bob Dylan, famous people. It has drawn famous people to it. And Steve Croman bought the building. The business person, Etienne Sugarman, of Made in New York fame, a pizza. There was a rumor there at one point that it was going to be a pizzeria. But now we hear that it'll be an upscale version of the White Horse Tavern itself. No longer a local, you know, affordable to the locals. We talked to one patron who said they would probably be closing April 9th. We can't verify that. But he said it'll be, instead of an $8 hamburger, it'll be a $28 hamburger. You know, and so we don't know. I called the number, it rang and rang, and then you get a staccato busy signal, so we don't know. But I feel it's closed. Mm-hmm. They'll do renovating, and supposedly it's to open as the White Horse, but very upscale.
Mm-hmm. And So you guys called me originally. I'm the Democratic district leader. I live two blocks from there. You had a demonstration. What are the demonstrators demanding? What are they trying to do?
Well, we try to save it from being closed and call attention to the fact of who bought it.
Yeah, I mean, the attention that we need to... When Croman buys a building, he totally destroys anything, any business that's in there, he usually gets rid of, including, and the tenants. And, you know, with the White Horse Tavern, the way that he went with the Amato Opera and Cafe Vivaldi, what he did to that, just drove them out. And he will do that here. Once the lease is up for this 15-year lease, you can bet that he's going to triple the rent and drive them out. And it's what he does to every one of his buildings. We had at the rally a good turnout because the weather was bad that day. It was raining and it was cold. But we had about 30 people, and we had Brad Hoylman came. State Senator Brad Hoylman. The chief of staff for Corey Johnson, his name was Eric Botcher. He came. Harry Bubbins for the Greenwich Village Society for Historic Preservation. I mean, they came. Housing Conservation Coordinator Natalie McJulich, she came.
And Jeremiah Morris came to witness more of Vanishing New York.
Yeah. And we had TV coverage and radio coverage, so it was good. It was drawing attention to it. You know, that we can't continue to let this happen to New York. It's just, you know, all our best places, our best restaurants, all these cultural and historic institutions are just being driven out. The artists are being driven out. We can only guess what's going to be happening to the tenants up above, you know, once Cuomo starts going after them.
And Malachy McCourt, author, raconteur, and has a program on WBAI, after the rally, he held a good old-fashioned Irish wake for the White Horse.
Yes, he was delightful. He told stories, he read poems, he sang, he got everybody else to sing all these beautiful old Irish songs. It was just so beautiful.
Did I read somewhere that there is a proposal to landmark the interior?
Yes. The Greenwich Village Society for Historic Preservation applied for it.
But it may be too late.
Well, I hope not.
The leaseholder may be at this very moment upgrading the interior.
Because
it's the outside that's landmark.
Yeah.
Right, the building itself is landmark, so they can't change the exterior.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But the inside's not.
But the tavern is not.
Yeah.
Is it closed as far as you know?
As far as we can, you know, the only thing is I called and it just rang. And they did say it was closing April 9th. So I have no idea. We have no idea. Mm-hmm. Have to drive by and take a look.
Yeah.
So if people want to, you know, join this cause, if people want to take up this cause, what can they do? How can they hook up with the Stop Cuomo Coalition and the fight to save this
$8
hamburger.
To speak to Andrew Berman or Harry Bubbins.
At the Greenwich Village.
And you can give out the website to the Stop Cuomo Coalition, Cynthia, since if there are Cuomo tenants.
It's StopCuomoCoalition.org.
And sometimes we call him Cuomo the Barbarian.
Are there any demonstrations planned in the near future?
Possibly. We're all the tenant groups, the Cuomo tenant groups from different areas of the city, we're getting together next month, and we have things planned because there's so many things that are going on that nothing's changed since the New York City management took over. And not only is Cuomo lurking around his buildings, but tenants are being made to suffer with the management, New York City management, and this company, Tenant Liaisons, actually hiring all of Cuomo's old supers, property managers, porters, the repair people, all these people that abused and harassed the tenants when they worked under Cuomo. These people have to let these same people into their home to work or look at them every day and deal with them. And it's such a horrible decision because people are suffering because of it. I mean, why didn't they just hire all new people? They didn't.
Well, I want to recommend that you guys contact the Attorney General's office as soon as possible. And what's the website again? Because if anybody is, I guess if anybody is being harassed, they can get in touch with you, right?
Sure, of course. It's www.stopcromincoalition.org.
Great. So thank you so much. Yes. I will stay in touch since I'm a local. And I've had many $8. Go ahead.
You know, American Greed did a show on Croman. I don't know if you know that, but that's on our website, too.
Great.
They made a film on Croman last September. So that's all, you could watch it on the website, too.
So I'll stay in touch, and I'll let listeners know if there's any actions planned or court appearances planned so people can join in. Thank you so much for being with us this afternoon.
And thank you.
We're going to resume after a short musical break. We don't get fooled again. And we're going to resume with some more examination of what is going on in the Democratic presidential primary among at least people that I consider to be progressive. So after a short break, we'll be back with Tulsi Gabbard. One of the most important things about the upcoming election in 2020, and I'm going to say this, I'm contrary to some, I think Eric Alterman in The Nation wrote a piece this week that said, we don't need the most progressive candidate, we need the one who's going to be able to beat Trump. And I guess that's going to be even a dividing line among people who are progressives in this country. We have incredible pressing problems in the United States. Just take climate change, for example. A moderate solution to climate change, which some people have called the most profound issue facing humanity, is not going to do the trick. And we need to listen to our candidates, and we need to support candidates who believe that the conditions on this planet are changing so drastically, so fast, that something needs to be done. Just last night, I saw waves in Lake Michigan, 10 to 12 foot waves battering Chicago. There aren't waves in Lake Michigan. There generally aren't waves in any of the Great Lakes. Waves are things that happen in oceans. There were these horrible winds and tornadoes as the weather systems move faster, and cold and hot get closer and closer together as the climate is changing. But we need people. So in my opinion, we need to listen to people. We need to listen to people whose programs are real. We need not to get fooled again. I listened to Cory Booker's launch yesterday, and he said that what we really need most in this country is love. We need to love everybody. We need to make peace with everyone. We need to just, you know, love the Republicans, and they'll see their, you know, see. And then he went through the list of all progressive causes, but his solution to getting there was to compromise. What I have been featuring are people who are running for president, and there are 16, 18, 19, 20 people who are running for president who are less into compromise. And one of those candidates who's gotten less press, but a fair amount of attention, is Tulsi Gabbard. She has her problems. Tulsi has gotten her, the Democratic National Committee has set a minimum of 65,000 contributors for somebody to get into the first debate. And maybe another, there may be one other qualification, like that you have to poll at least 1% in the polls or something like that. But you have to have at least 65,000 contributors. And she passed that number a couple of weeks ago. So quietly she's passed that number. Tulsi Gabbard is a representative. She was a House member. I think she stepped down after the last in the last cycle. So she could run for president. She's from Hawaii. She was a rebel on the Democratic National Committee. She was a member of Congress who, had her own perspective. And one of the interesting voices that she brings to this race is about foreign policy and about the need to avoid interventionist wars. So we're going to listen a little bit to Tulsi Gabbard, two pieces, and then we'll get back on the air.
There are a lot of different issues that we need to address. I've mentioned a few of them. Dealing with the climate crisis that we're facing in this country and in the world is an urgent one that we all must stand up to demand real change to address. We've been talking about this issue for a while. We've been talking about how our policies and the way that we live has a negative impact on our environment. But we have not yet seen that kind of bold action and recognition from our leaders. That has to change. We also have to recognize how important it is that even as we take aggressive action to address this climate crisis in this country, that alone will not be enough. This is a problem that is facing our planet. It is facing every country in this world. And in order to tackle it, it will require us to build relationships based on cooperation, not conflict, with other countries in the world, and work together to address this crisis. Doing things like re-entering the Paris Accords is a necessary and important step, but that alone will not be enough. Retracting from the world and treating other countries in this zero-sum mentality where you're either with us or against us, with this approach of conflict rather than cooperation, must end. Because it threatens our future. I want to close by talking about an issue that is central to all of these others that are pressing and urgent and impact our everyday lives, and that is the issue of the cost of war. I am a major in the Army National Guard, been serving now for almost 15 years. Deployed twice to the Middle East, where I served in a medical unit on that first deployment to Iraq in 2005, where I saw firsthand every day the high human cost of war and who pays the price. I saw it in friends of mine who were killed in combat, who never made that trip home with us. I see it in my brothers and sisters, our veterans, who continue to pay the price after coming home, dealing with wounds, both visible and invisible. The lack of quality care and benefits provided to them to help them when they come home. But the price for these wars that people don't often recognize is the one that every single one of us pays. The fact that we are spending trillions of dollars on wasteful regime change wars, on this new Cold War between the United States and nuclear-armed countries like Russia and China as tensions continue to increase, and this nuclear arms race that has been kicked off by actions like the one President Trump took recently in withdrawing from this historic INF treaty, negotiated between Reagan and Gorbachev. These actions have put us as a country and the world in a position where we are at a greater risk of nuclear catastrophe than ever before in history. Now, what's interesting is, as I share this information and talk about these issues with leaders in Washington, they say, really? Really? More than the Cuban Missile Crisis? More than the Cold War with the Soviet Union? Yes, the answer is yes. This is the reality of the threat, the existential threat we're facing today, and it should alarm every one of us here that leaders in Washington are either not paying attention, they don't know, or they don't care. This should alarm every one of us because that means not only are we not addressing this threat, but the actions that leaders in Washington are taking are actually making it worse. There are a lot of challenges that we're facing. And it's heartbreaking to see in so many different ways how we're being torn apart as people, how our country is being divided, how that vision that our founders had for us as a country, as a united country with a government of, by, and for the people has been lost. It is hard to see, and it's heartbreaking to see how, because of that, people are suffering. Our family, our friends, our neighbors are dealing with things that we shouldn't have to be dealing with in this country. We're in a place where we have a government that is not of the people, by the people, and for the people, but rather a government that is controlled and influenced by self-serving politicians, greedy corporations, and those special interests who can afford to buy their seat at the table as laws are being made. And who pays the price? We do. Who suffers as a result? We do. Who is left behind? We are. The place that we are in as a country right now is exactly counter to the vision that our founders had for this great country, where we have leaders elected by the people who are of the people and for the people and whose sole interest and focus is on serving the interests of the people of this country. We must change our foreign policy, the way we are relating to different countries, and build those relationships based on cooperation, not conflict, and work towards this future where we are getting rid of nuclear weapons rather than building more of them. To build this future where we are taking those trillions of dollars being spent on wasteful regime change wars and a nuclear arms race, and taking those dollars and bringing them to serve the needs of people here at home. To make sure that we have health care for everyone, to make sure our kids have a great education and a great future, to invest in a green, renewable, energy-based economy that serves us today and for generations to come. To make sure that we're investing in the right kind of infrastructure and sustainable agriculture. There are so many things that we need to do right now to invest in a bright future for every single American. In order to do that, we have to change that course that we are on. Take those dollars, end those wasteful regime change wars, this nuclear arms race and new Cold War, and put those dollars, place our priorities where they need to be, which is right here on our people, on our families, and on our future.
So there aren't a lot of candidates who are talking about U.S. foreign policy, yet it's one of the most critical parts of what a president of the United States does. Is he or she is in charge of U.S. foreign policy. I grew up, I became of political age where there were domestic issues with the civil rights movement and the attacks, you know, when I was 15 on the Black Panther Party. And then, but also at the same time, we were fighting a war in Vietnam and nobody totally understood why we were fighting this war in Vietnam. And then the more I looked into it, the more I found out about what the U.S. did to change regimes all over the world in order to make the world safer for U.S. corporations, which we used to call U.S. imperialism. I haven't heard that phrase used for a while, except by people like Maduro. But she's talking about it. She's talking about, do we really need to be, why are we in Syria? She fought in Afghanistan. She saw people killed in Afghanistan. She didn't understand why and still doesn't understand why we're fighting wars in places where the end result is only to strengthen barbarians like those in Al-Qaeda. Too much of our knee-jerk reaction to whatever Trump does is that when he says we're going to pull troops out of Syria is to say, oh, Trump wants it, it must be bad. Because in fact, the United States still has its fingers in too many places around the world, and too many people who are running for political office, particularly who are running for president, don't talk about it. They don't talk about foreign policy. They don't talk about the saber rattling in Venezuela. For whatever that is good or bad about Maduro, and maybe I should do a show about Venezuela, the U.S. has no business propping up an opposition, no business getting involved in the internal politics of another nation. We have no business in you know, there are ways that we do it without even sending troops. It's not our business. And you know, Trump keeps saying that with respect to Venezuela that everything's on the table, but hopefully intervention isn't on the table. But there aren't enough politicians who are saying, you know what, we have to let the Venezuelans figure it out for themselves. Let the Venezuelans fight their battles out on their own, just like we let the British fight it out amongst themselves. Why do we have to intervene in Venezuela? And she's one of the only candidates that's saying that. Bernie Sanders is saying it too, not quite as much. But Tulsi Gabbard, and the reason I think that she has developed a following is because she's the peace candidate. She's the anti-war candidate of the 2020 election. And despite, you know, she was raised in a Hindu household. She has some serious past issues with about LGBT issues, and I'm not sure whether they could ever, you know, be overcome in the course of this election, but she's trying. She's been self-critical. But the issues that she raises, and she's going to be on that podium, at least in the first bunch of debates, and she's going to make the other candidates talk about foreign policy, which, you know, still we spend, and what she talks about, you know, when Bernie Sanders and some of the other candidates, but Bernie certainly is the Medicare for All guy, they say, how are we going to find the money for Medicare for All? Where are we going to find the money for the Green New Deal? Oh, it's going to cost trillions of dollars. And then we realize we spend hundreds of billions of dollars on U.S. troops stationed all over the world, fighting in Syria, fighting in Afghanistan, fighting in places we don't even know we're fighting. We spend billions and hundreds of billions of dollars a year on buying the latest aircraft with the latest bombs and the latest means of carrying out warfare all over the world. And if we didn't do that, if we didn't spend the money on that, and I think peace activists have been saying this since the 1960s, if not before, there would be that the money that goes into that is money that could be used on healthcare, could be used on education, it could be used on criminal justice reform. It could be used to, even as Andrew Wang, as we heard in last week's show, talks about having a guaranteed minimum wage for people. It's another source of money that too often, you know, I don't hear the Cory Bookers and the Joe Bidens of the world talking about any kind of a peace dividend. I don't hear people who say that they're progressive talking enough about the most important part of what the United States president does. And interestingly, if one looks at the polls, Trump's approval rating, which is generally run at between 40 and 45% over most of his presidency, but on foreign policy, he actually runs in the high 30s. People in the United States aren't particularly happy with how he has handled himself around the world. And it's going to be critical for a Democratic president to, you know, and a Democratic candidate to define him or herself around the peace dividend that we have. Just for, again, this is Arthur Schwartz, run Advocating for Justice on WBAI 99.5 FM. We are always at a time when we need money. It's astounding, as I've learned. I've been here now almost 2 years doing this show, almost every Monday, in the studio here at Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn, and how this station always, you know, is hanging by a thread. Last year, it overcame this problem with an antenna at the Empire State Building, but that was solved not by the people who were trying to extort millions of dollars from WBAI going away. It came in the form of a loan, which basically just spread out the time that the station has to pay back the money that that was being asked of it. This is important radio. This is critical radio in New York, and it's going to be critical over the next year. And I know that when I was a teenager, when I was listening to about the anti-war movement and I was listening to what was going on, you know, with the civil rights movement in the 1960s, and when I was trying to make sense of the cultural changes that were going on, I listened to WBA. I would play, you know, there'd be a demonstration in Washington and I was too young to go, and I would play it on the radio, or I would get the latest news about a march that might be going down, you know, Fifth Avenue from some, you know, point around some issue in the war in Vietnam. There aren't a lot of stations that do this. There are other public interest stations, like, well, I'm not even going to put their names on the air, but they don't really cover the movement. They don't cover the movement. And this station has been continuously attempting to reshape and adjust to the politics, the progressive politics of the era, and I think that's still going on here, but it's not going to be able to do that unless people pledge money. People make a pledge, small amount of money. You know, the candidates, we see Bernie Sanders raised $18 million in the first 41 days of this year, and Pete Buttigieg raised $7 million, and Beto O'Rourke raised $9 million, and, you know, they're all trying to appeal to progressive people. Well, let me tell you, if just the listeners that turn on at 99.5 FM in New York were to each donate $20, if everybody listening, and they did it once a month, like people are pledging to, whether it's Bernie or Kamala Harris or whoever you want to pledge money to, this station would have no problem doing what we wanted to do. And being there as the next year unfolds and the movements for social change unfold. And it's a movement, and we're going to talk about this. I'm not going to be on next week, but on the 29th, we're going to talk about, you know, what's happened in Albany since the Democrats took over the state Senate, and what has happened and what hasn't happened in Albany. And, you know, we won't get fooled again. Well, you know, we may have had too high an expectation of what just winning one house was going to do. Anyway, as a last piece before I sign off for 2 weeks, my favorite person in the presidential election isn't somebody who's running for president. She's supporting Bernie Sanders. But if there is any person out there who talks with the passion that we need to be brought into presidential politics, it's Nina Turner, who was the president of our revolution, is now the chair of Bernie Sanders' campaign. And we're going to just listen to end the show with a recent speech that she gave, where she talks about why this whole race is important.
The senator understands that he cannot do this alone. He met with many groups this morning and he said these words that when I become president of the United States of America, I need millions and millions of people across this country who are willing to step up for a political revolution that is transformative. This is about transformation. And as Brother Frederick Douglass put it, sisters and brothers, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has, and it never will. We are demanding some stuff in this country. That is not okay for the ultra wealthy to have everything, and we have nothing. That the working class people from all walks in this life in this country deserve to live a good life. You 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 deserve to live a good life. And what the system understands is that we have in Senator Sanders someone who tells the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help us, God. He dared us to dream bigger dreams. That it is unconscionable in the wealthiest nation on the face of the earth that people don't have health care that provides for them to live a good life. He spoke that truth in 2016. But sisters, brother, he's been speaking that truth for a long time. We got the receipts. Go back 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, speaking the truth. He's a visionary. His lived experience. He has that heart-soul agreement that is necessary for transcendence. But we cannot do it without you. So, sisters, brother, can you do something for a sister? All of you who have cell phones, if you have not signed up to be one in a million, I need you to go to BernieSanders.com right now to become one in a million. Because when there are millions and millions and millions and millions of us on the move, there is no power on the face of the earth greater than a conscious-minded people on the move. We need you. You got to commit to bringing some folks out to vote, California. Bring some people. Because we are going to finish what we started in 2016. We gonna do that. And with these hands, if you have a hand, those of you who can raise your hands, even on behalf of people who might not be able to do it, I want you to vibe with a sister today. Lift your hands for yourself and somebody else. With these hands, we will have Medicare for all in this country. With these hands, we will have college for all and trade schools. With these hands, we will ensure that our children are able to live a better life than we are living right now. With these hands, we will take care of Mother Earth. With these hands, we will pass the ERA. Shout out, ladies. With these hands, we will deal with a criminal justice system that sees too many black and brown and Native American folks as criminals in this country. With these hands, we will move towards transcendence. And this mission is so high, sisters and brothers, we can't get over it. And this mission is so low, we can't get under it. And this mission is so wide, we cannot get around it. With these hands, with these hands, with these hands, we will elect the senator from Vermont. With these hands, we will elect the freedom fighter for justice. With these hands, we will elect a courageous champion who doesn't depend on polling to tell him how he should feel. With these hands, we will elect a president that has looked at Wall Street and said, enough is enough, and you will not continue to treat people this way. With these hands, sisters and brothers, we will elect Senator Bernie Sanders, the next president of the United States of America. With these hands. With these hands. With these hands.
And with this mouth, I sign off for this week. And I'll see everybody on April 29th. Next week, there's a special for Earth Day. It's a profound time to have an Earth Day, and I've been preempted by some special programming. But we'll be back on April 29th to continue this show about the movement in all of its glory, and nobody says it better than Nina Turner did. See you on the 29th.
Up there beyond the sky, it's been a long time coming, but I know a change will come. Oh, yes it will. It's been times when I thought I couldn't last this long.
The nation's top seven young jazz pianists are coming to New York City for one spectacular day of performances. On Monday, April 15th, the American Jazz Pianist Competition will take place at Yamaha Artists Services Center in Manhattan at 689 Fifth Avenue. Performers will compete for national acclaim plus outstanding prizes offered by Kessler Collection Hotels, Busendorfer, and Yamaha Pianos. The competition will be broadcasted live for the 2 p.m. solo finals and the 7 p.m. trio finals Eastern Standard Time. Tickets for this live event can be found online at www.AmericanJazzPianistCompetition.org or by calling our ticket hotline at 321-768-2221.
Brooklyn for Peace presents In Forum, How Pentagon Spending Robs Cities of Funds Needed to Provide Basic Municipal Services. Thursday, April 18th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Brooklyn Friends Meeting House, 110 Schermerhorn Street at Borum Place in downtown Brooklyn. Bill Hartung of the Center for International Policy will speak on specific ways the war economy drains New York City resources and what people can do to turn it around. Two campaigns, Move the Money and Divest from the War Machine, will form working groups to plan actions. Admission is free. For more information, call Brooklyn for Peace at 718-624-5921 or visit brooklynpeace.org. That's Thursday, April 18, 7 to 9 p.m. at Brooklyn Friends Meeting House, 110 Schermerhorn Street at Borum Place in downtown Brooklyn.
Saturday, April 27th, please come to a concert of Songs for Solidarity featuring Mario Conkel, Lindsay Wilson, and myself, Judy Gorman. 100% of all proceeds will support asylum-seeking immigrant families now living with members and friends of the First Unitarian Congregation of Brooklyn in downtown Brooklyn. For info, please go to songsforsolidarity.bpt.me. songsforsolidarity.bpt.me. Thank you.
This is WBAI New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. The previous program was Advocating for Justice with Arthur Schwartz, heard Mondays at 5 p.m. Stay tuned for the WBAI Evening News being presented by The Independent, coming up at 6 p.m., followed by Counterspin at 6:30. And then at 7 p.m., we continue on with our special of the American Jazz Piece.